felt good. I felt comfortable out there. I felt like I did all the right things to prepare for this game.
Oh, Montoya diving back.
They came on the road and played a good game.
They were protecting the puck. They were moving the puck.
Stewart's driving away on McGinn. Stewart hammering him.
Salovier center point. Tees it up. Shoots.
Big plays, the big stories, the biggest news from across the hockey landscape. This is NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290.
TSN1290.ca.
Good evening, Manitoba. Good evening, Winnipeg. And for all those joining us live at TSN1290.ca, good evening, universe, and welcome to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air like the expert that he is. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. Follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com. Coming up on this evening's program in about 15 minutes' time, we're going to be joined by our good friend Matty Lachlan. He is the New Jersey Devils play-by-play voice on WFAN Radio in New York. The Devils are off to a surprising start this year, so we want to talk to Matty about the Devils, a team most probably would think that he's going to take a step back this year, are able now to still be performing at this high level. We'll get to that coming up in about 15 minutes' time, and then some of our regular features throughout the course of the show that you've come to know and love in the 1 week that this program has been on the air. Gentlemen, let's start with Evander Kane, the Winnipeg Jets forward. Stoked some fires earlier today with some comments that were released ahead of a comprehensive and more fulsome interview that's going to be released in the Hockey News on March the 4th, the March 4th issue of the Hockey News. Evander Kane said, and I quote, "I think a good portion of the criticism I've received is because I'm black, and I'm not afraid to say that." He then further went on to say he doesn't feel like a victim, and he doesn't want to be perceived as one. These quotes taken on their own, without the full context of the interview, probably will and already have started to ruffle some feathers. The problem that I have with them is we don't know their full context. So we don't know if Evander Kane is calling out people on Twitter, or if Evander Kane is calling out columnists or radio personalities or whomever who write about the Jets and potentially criticize the Jets and Evander Kane on a day-to-day basis. There is obviously an element of race. We'd be naive to say there's no racism involved. But in your opinion, and I'm not, you know, Evander's entitled to whatever opinion he may have. In your opinion, do you think that Evander Kane is justified in saying that most of his criticism has to do with race?
No, Drew, I would disagree with him entirely in terms of saying that most of it has to do with race. As you said before, a portion of it has to do with race. We would be naive to think otherwise, in my opinion. But the majority of the criticism he receives is more so due to his attitude, in Winnipeg at least, to a hesitancy to, for whatever reason, not really take the city on as his own.
To embrace the city, like you're saying?
To embrace the city. I think overall, the perception from afar or from close is that he's not overly well-liked by his teammates. He has a certain cockiness and a swagger to him. I think those are the main reasons why. I don't think it's because of his race. And, you know, I think you want to look at his teammate, Dustin Byfuglien. Dustin Byfuglien gets criticized, certainly not as much as Evander Kane. Is a portion of that racism? It may very well be. But Dustin Byfuglien doesn't get criticized close to as much as Evander Kane. It's two different personalities. And Byfuglien's personality is a more likable personality.
And you're using Dustin Byfuglien as an example because he's also a racial minority. He's African American as well.
Mm-hmm.
Evander Kane, obviously from BC, African Canadian or whatever the politically correct terminology is there. But two guys of the similar race who are treated differently, largely, I would suggest you're probably correct, because of their public perception and the attitude in which they give off. Ezzy, before I let you jump in, here's another quote from Evander Kane. This is an additionally released quote. I guess this would have to do in regards to his perceived arrogance. It's just the way I'm wired, Evander Kane told Ken Campbell of the Hockey News. Maybe my parents love me the proper way, so I love myself. I mean, I don't really fault the guy for being arrogant, but when you make comments like that and some of the previous comments we've seen him make, you're going to be, you're out there, so you're going to be the victim of more criticism.
Drew, at the top of the hour, you mentioned that, Kane's entitled to his own, Evander Kane is entitled to his own opinions. And, these tweets just came out earlier today, and when a tweet like that comes out, it's extremely dangerous stuff. If there is racism going on in Winnipeg against Kane, whether it's from, they had Ken Campbell on Hustler and Lawless right before we came on, and we haven't read the whole article, just like you said. Hasn't been published. It won't be published for three and a half weeks. And we don't know the context, like you said. But when these comments come out, it's disturbing. You don't want a guy like Evander Kane have to experience racism, especially, with everything that's happened, in the world, and things have gotten better. And we'd be naive to not think that racism doesn't go on in the world of hockey, the world of professional sports. But we only know from our own personal experience, and I can say that from my own personal experience with Evander Kane talking to fans or media or other players, racism hasn't come up once. But if it has come up for him, we don't follow him around day to day. We don't read his tweet. We don't hear the conversations that he has. If that's the case, then that's terrible. But as far as that being a systemic problem in this city or in other cities, I haven't heard of any of that. And I think I speak for a lot of people when I would hear that's shocking. Now, if it's something that's specifically geared towards him in isolated incidents, well, that's a different thing.
I'm sure his Twitter feed, and this is, and I really believe that this is largely Twitter-based, because everybody's a big man or a big woman behind the anonymity of a computer screen. You can be a big, tough talker behind the screen. You won't, face-to-face, you'd never do it. Mm-hmm. So I definitely think that this is Twitter-related. But do you honestly think that if he was in Toronto or Vancouver or any of the probably bigger cities that he thinks he should be in or that his star power should be in, the racism, if there is any, wouldn't be just as bad, if not worse?
Let me get in here for 1 second. We know, and I know Richie's off Twitter now, but I'm big on Twitter. I'm on Twitter every day, and I know for a fact that the comments on Twitter are absolutely ridiculous, not just against hockey players, but against world events, what's going on. And if you hashtag any type of racist term or whatever, you're going to find people out there that are using them. And it is a problem, and it's disgusting that people use Twitter as a way to express their racist views. And it's tough to police it, Drew, because who are you going after? And if that's the case, again, that he's getting a brunt of it, I don't think that's necessarily reflective of the typical hockey fan, but it doesn't mean that it's all right on the other hand either.
Evander Kane, he hasn't become a well-liked figure in the city when it's really there for the taking.
It's been there for the taking from day one.
He is arguably the most talented, naturally talented player on the team. Scored 30 goals in his third season in the National Hockey League. This year is a year, he had an issue with the contract, but that was signed before the lockout. He hasn't got going yet. It's expected that he will. I thought he played better yesterday, got 6 shots on net. But the point is this, Drew. This city is dying for their next Teemu Selänne. And I think, for the most part, collectively, this is a big, small town, and I think there's a fairly good collective judge of character. And for whatever reason, the city is not taking to Evander Kane. And I personally think that says more about Evander Kane than it does about the people as a whole.
If Evander Kane, at any time in the past year or year and a half, had come out and just embraced the city, even if it's complete and total bull, even if he doesn't mean it, if he comes out and he says a couple nice things here and there and every now and then and says, great time in Winnipeg, like Bogosian does or Byfuglien. Byfuglien doesn't even say anything and people like him. Then people would embrace him. There'd still be racism, buddy. There'd still be racists on the internet because they exist. And they're going to exist wherever you are. But, the reason why you haven't been embraced by the city of Winnipeg is largely a lot of your own doing.
Well, there's two issues here, though. There is he is Evander Kane personally experiencing racism? And is not only that, is he experiencing it? Is it widespread, meaning he's getting a lot of tweets on a daily basis, or he's getting emails, or people are saying things to him on the street or in the store? That's one issue. The other issue is, does the city of Winnipeg and its hockey fans as a whole have a problem with Evander Kane because of his race? And I think unquestionably that is not the case.
Michael Landsberg had him on last year, and he asked him, you know, what's your favorite place to be in Winnipeg? My house. And so, again, like, he gives them these carrots, you dangle the carrots, and he hasn't taken them for whatever reason.
People would be happy to do, but, you know, people have given you the opportunity to do a puff piece, you know, to just come out and say your platitudes. That's all they are.
Interesting that he has the interview with the Hockey News,
yeah,
based out of Toronto.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want to interpret, if you want to read anything into that or not. But you might be able to. I don't know if you want to really delve deeper. I'm sure there are conspiracy theorists, and I'll just bring it up. The fact that he's saying something like this, he may very well, probably does believe it, but he may also think that it will cause a little bit of controversy. He may think it may end up in him being shut out of town. I think that's way too many steps down the road, but I'm sure there will be people who bring that up.
Well, it'll be interesting tomorrow, because obviously he made these comments on it, or these comments came out, and there was no media availability today for the Winnipeg Jets. Tomorrow he's going to be...
Because we should mention they had a day off.
They had a day off. They had an off day today. Yeah. Nothing to read into that.
Yeah.
Tomorrow he's going to be front and center. He's going to have the cameras shining the light on, right on him. And I don't think he's going to be apologetic. And I don't really mind that. If he believes what he believes, that's fine. I'm okay with that. Don't say a comment and then back off on it. You know, if he truly believes it, either clarify it or double down on it. But, you know, if it's, you know, I'd rather see a guy stand by his beliefs, however wrong-headed they may or may not be, but they're his beliefs, so that's not for me to say, than a guy, you know, who's going to make a comment and then the next day try and pull it back.
I would be surprised if he pulled it back.
He didn't pull it back on the money phone from Vegas. He said it was funny. That's his opinion, and I right. don't fault the
and
guy
most
for
people
that.
Didn't find it funny and thought the timing was terrible. I'll tell you this much,
but
Drew.
But I don't think that they didn't like it because of his race.
Give him credit that he stands by it, though.
Full marks for that. I can't stand, if there's anything I hate more than a guy making bold comments, it's a guy making bold comments who pulls him back with mealy-mouthed apologies.
That's like Kyle Turris within the Globe earlier this year.
That's right, when he was complaining about playing over in... Oh, so what did he threw the interviewer under the bus. Well, Kyle, it was on tape, buddy.
And if this is a case of fans or just general people out in the streets of Winnipeg making racist comments, the important thing is here, we don't condone that. It's absolutely ridiculous.
Yes.
And in this day and age, you're cowardly, and it's unacceptable to use that against someone and to say that to someone on the street. And that's the most important thing. If that's the case, and it looks like he will stand by it,
we'll see.
Why wouldn't he? Because this is his own personal experience. It's absolutely unacceptable. And in this day and age, it's disgusting that people still have these views in of other people.
Absolutely. We're certainly not. I'm sure he has been the victim of racism. And it's absolutely abhorrent. And it's embarrassing. The person who makes any sort of racial comments should be ashamed of themselves. But to tar an entire city or an entire fan base, you know, with that same brush, I think is a little bit irresponsible. Prior to the show, we did reach out to Evander Kane's agent, Craig Oster, also actually a Winnipegger who went to law school here at U of M.
Business school, pardon me,
here at
Careful,
U of M.
Richie's a lawyer.
Yeah, I know. I wouldn't want to insult Richie.
That's not why I wanted to have an accurate reflection of what his credentials are.
Craig Oster replied and said, thank you for our interest in this matter. No need for Evander Kane to make any further comments at this time. So really a no comment from Evander Kane's representative, Craig Oster.
Not surprising.
Let's go to break. When we come back, Matt Lachlan of WFAN Radio, he's the New Jersey Devils play-by-play man, he's going to join us. You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And our website is www.illegalcurve.com.
The TSN 1290 NHL Midweek Hotline.
Let's welcome to NHL Midweek. He's our good friend from WFAN Radio in New York City. He's the New Jersey Devils play-by-play man, Matty Lachlan. Matty, how are you, bud?
Fellas, I'm doing great. It's always good to join you guys and talk some hockey. And Looking forward to our meetings with the Jets coming up here in the next few weeks.
Absolutely. We're going to see the Devils three times in the span of just a couple of weeks coming up, you know, not too long from now, especially as the Jets embark on that big, long road trip. You know, Matt, you look at the Devils through 13 games this season, 8-2-3. You know, at what point in time do we as sort of a collective hockey world stop writing off the New Jersey Devils?
I'm chuckling because that's a question I asked rhetorically on the air the other night, because the Devils, while they lost last night and saw a five-game winning streak come to an end, during that streak they played the Penguins twice, the Rangers, a hot up until then Tampa Bay team, and the New York Islanders. And before the Ranger game, the questions to Pete DeBoer had to do with, well, how are you going to contain Rick Nash and Marion Gaborik and Brad Richards? Not to deny their talent, how are you going to beat Henrik Lundqvist? And then with Tampa Bay, they were high-flying, so you've got Steven Stamkos and this leading scoring team in the league, and Pittsburgh and Malkin and Crosby and Neal and Kunitz. And I thought at some point somebody should stand up and say the Devils were the team that went to the Stanley Cup final last year. Not that those teams aren't formidable foes, but shouldn't the question be, what do they have to do to get past the Devil? So, yeah, I'm glad that you asked that question. I think that now with this winning streak and the way they've gotten off to the good start, again, although the streak ended last night, that I think people are starting to recognize that it wasn't necessarily a fluke, that there are some real big, important pieces that came back from last year's team. And while the loss of Zach Parise was important, they still return, you know, the Calder finalist in Adam Henrik and Ilya Kovalchuk and Patrick Elias, two guys who finished in the top 10 in scoring last year, and the ageless wonders in goal, Marty Brodeur and Johan Hedberg. So I think people are starting to recognize that this team is for real and not an easy out at all.
Matty, I'll admit to you right off the bat that the Devils fan comes out in me, and me being a fan of David Clarkson comes out in me. And I talked about him last week on our debut show about, you know, how you can't write him off as a one-season wonder. But is it possible that David Clarkson's getting better this year?
Well, there is, and there's another player who I think had a lot to prove. I mean, obviously, he had the 30-goal season last year, first time, and there's always a question of whether you're a one-hit wonder or not. But what David has done in his 6 years in the league is continue to improve. And what he's done, he's been very self-critical. He's looked at his game when the season is over and said, okay, where do I need to get better? Where are some of my weaknesses? And he was never a very strong skater. Well, last summer, he did a lot of work with power skaters, instructors, and just a lot of work on his core. Went to work with Gary Roberts, and we know what a noted workout fiend he is. And you can see it this year. David's not knocked off the puck as easily. He scored a goal the other night in Pittsburgh Sunday night where, you know, he had great drive, knee bend. The legs were separated and to the point where he had a wide base and he was able to hold off the defenseman, and he roofed a shot over Marc-Andre Fleury. It was a beautiful play, and that's not something he would have done 2 years ago or been able to do. So he always works on his weaknesses, and he goes to the dirty areas. So he has gotten off to such a great start that he has dispelled the doubts as to whether or not, you know, he'll never be considered an elite goal scorer because his skill set doesn't stand out like a, you know, Stamkos or like a Kovalchuk or players of that stature. But he is more than capable of scoring 20 goals in this lockout shortened season. Don't know if he'll approach 30. That's probably a lot to ask. But, you know, he has proven himself to be a very good scorer, no question.
Matt, you look at the Devils' success thus far, and one thing that stands out in terms of the stat sheet is that Travis Zajac only has 3 points in 13 games. Is it a matter of time for him?
I think the Devils are certainly hoping so, and I think it is. What he has said and what Pete DeBoer has said are the things that players and coaches say all the time, which is, well, he's seeing a lot of ice time, which means he's doing all the right things. We like what he's doing in our zone defensively. We like the way he's taking faceoffs. He's one of our leaders. You don't have to worry about him, et cetera. And I don't think there's worry, but the fact of the matter is, while, you know, Travis is again, not one of the guys that you think of as a big-time scorer, he wants to get on the score sheet. And he got off to the great start, scored a goal in each of the first two games, and has had just one assist since then. And while all the other facets of his game are there, you know, I know it's weighing on his mind. He's saying one thing, but I know he's feeling the other. I don't think there's cause for worry because he's had some opportunities, but I'm sure there'll be a big monkey off his back when he does score. When that'll happen, I don't know. Perhaps Friday against Philadelphia. Everything else is great about his game. He just needs to put some points on the board, no doubt.
Matt, any concern at all about the lingering effects of last year's surgery?
Doesn't appear to be. He's skating well. Now, last night he saw the least amount of ice time than he had seen throughout the season. So, you know, maybe Pete saw some signs of struggle, some signs of tightness. It was not apparent to me, but, you know, with that experience, bird's eye view behind the bench, maybe Pete saw something that I didn't see. Plus, the team was not generating a whole heck of a lot through the first two periods. They were beaten to loose pucks. Carolina was the better, faster team, so Pete just tried to shake things up a little bit. All that being said, I don't think there's any lingering effects of the Achilles injury. He proved himself in the playoffs last year. He had 7 goals and 14 points. So I just think it's a bit of puck luck. It's just one of those things that the hockey gods throw at you to test your mettle. And I do think it's a matter of time. There's nothing that stands out in this game that he's not doing, so it's just one of those things.
We're joined on NHL Midweek by Matt Lachlan. He is the play-by-play man for the New Jersey Devils on WFAN Radio. Matt, you know, obviously the lockout is nothing that any of us wanted, and we were, you know, had those lean months, say, between September and January when there should have been hockey. But for the New Jersey Devils, you know, given the extra hockey they played last year, making it all the way to the Stanley Cup Finals, is the extended break because of the lockout, is it a blessing in disguise when looking at the rest it gave to Brodeur and Hedberg?
I think to a degree it is. I think it probably went too long for anyone's liking.
Obviously.
But there's no question that the Devils is the oldest team on average, and that's skewed a little bit by the age of the goaltenders, but nonetheless, the oldest team in the National Hockey League on average, benefited by a little bit of a delay in the start. I mean, it was a grind, it was hard, and they fell just short. And for them to have come back and had camp in September might have been a little more difficult. Again, that being said, January was too long to wait. So there might be some benefit to it, but then there's that chance that it would have turned into rust. We haven't seen that, obviously. So, yeah, I guess in its totality, it probably is a good thing. Now, the compact schedule, talk to me in March, when the games really have clashed one upon another, and to see whether or not this older team can handle that daily grind. So it's good at the beginning in a way, but it may be bad at the end. We'll see. But overall, I think having some time off probably was a good thing.
Matt, earlier this month, the Devils recalled Stefan Matteau from the QMJHL. How would you rate his play thus far, and do you think he's going to stick with the Devils?
I think he will. You know, the junior playoffs are almost just around the corner, and he certainly has crossed that 5-game threshold where his entry-level contract kicks in, and he has proven himself capable of playing at this level. I just don't know how much he will contribute, and I say that simply because you look at what he does, and he's big and he's strong, and he's not afraid of the physical play. But he is 18 years of age, and while there's no doubt he's an NHLer, you can just see by the way he carries himself and plays that, you know, he's obviously in the NHL, but certainly will have a long NHL career. It's still such a huge jump, and it may be something that he would benefit more by playing back in Major Junior again. But I don't think, given the injury to Dynas Zubrus, that's necessarily the direction they're going to go. You know, he came back into the lineup and crossed that 5-game threshold when Zubrus went out with an injury. Dynas has now been placed on the injured reserve list, and so he'll be gone for a little bit longer, it appears. So I think Stefan is here to stay. He'll learn up here. He drinks everything in. He's got a great hockey sense. But, you know, his development might be better if he spent time playing with kids his own age and dominating a little bit. But that's not the circumstance. He doesn't look out of place. He just looks like he probably needs a little more seasoning. But, again, he's definitely an NHLer.
Matt, did you ever think you'd see the day when Stefan Matteau was said in a positive manner around the New Jersey Devils?
No, and it was funny when he scored his first goal Saturday against Pittsburgh. Chico Resch, who does the commentary on TV, did a funny kind of, oh, Matteau, mimicking Howie Rose's great call when his dad scored that goal in 1994. So yeah, it's very interesting. You know, when we had camp, finally got back Matteau was assigned right next to Marty Brodeur, which was incredible. But, you know, again, they speak the same language, and, you know, Marty the veteran, who else better, though they play different positions, and to watch and learn how a veteran handles himself. But that was an interesting placement, you know, the kid whose father in 94 scored one of the great playoff goals to eliminate the Devils, and the kid upon whom the Devils will build their future around. So, yeah, very interesting placement by Lou Lamoriello of those locker spots.
You know, Matt, you've mentioned Pete DeBoer a couple of times, and he lost some assistant coaches in the offseason, and Larry Robinson and Adam Oates. How has he fared? I mean, obviously the team's off to a great start, but how has he adjusted his coaching style with different assistants behind the bench?
Yeah, I don't think that there's been much of an adjustment, quite frankly. Matt Shaw, who came in this year, has had experience before in San Jose, worked in the Minnesota game, worked alongside Dave Barr when they were together in Houston, which is Minnesota's top affiliate. So he's got a lot of hockey experience, and he's kind of fit in pretty seamlessly. And then in the Adam Oates spot, if you will, though, different responsibilities, but still he's doing the power play as Adam did, but again comes in with a little bit of a different responsibility. And then he replaced one Hall of Famer with another, Scott Stevens. And you know, the Devils had an optional skate today, and I was hoping there'd be a few more guys around, because I want to speak with some of the defensemen as to what the difference is. Larry was always noted as this great teacher, and Scott, in his first year, has a different voice, and I just want to know what might be different. The same principles, but how it's delivered. But the players, the players have responded, and so Pete's strength is that he's a great delegator. He has the last say. He is the head coach, but he delegates, and at the same time, he's open to suggestions. So it's really been a very good transition. You know, again, Scott was around last year as a consultant. Saw a lot of games, has spent some time on the ice with the guys in the past, so it's not like he came out of the blue. And Matt Shaw's power play is starting to click, and that's what he was brought in to do principally, and it's starting to work pretty well.
Matt Laughlin, he's the Devils broadcaster on WFAN Radio. Thanks, as always, for joining us on NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show, and we'll see you in the Peg coming up very shortly.
Looking forward to it. Kicks off a three-game road trip. We start off in Winnipeg, and looking forward to getting back there. It was great last year. The joint was jumping. It is again this year. So a lot of fun, and looking forward to it, fellas.
Thanks, Matt. Take care of yourself.
Thanks a lot, Matt.
All right, take care. Bye-bye.
Let's go to break. You're listening to TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Joined in studio by Ezra Ginsberg and Richard Pollock. Producer Remus gets us on and off the air. Big thank you to Maddie Laughlin from WFAN Radio in New York for having joined us, in case you missed any of that. We'll have the show available for you on iTunes and on the TSN1290.ca website and on IllegalCurve.com, of course. Gentlemen, realignment is back in the news in the for the NHL. It's something that's obviously been sort of hanging over the league, especially since the NHLPA first rejected the proposed realignment offer. Apparently, it's back on the table. And for the most part, from what I can see, there's not very much difference between what the NHL tried to do the first time versus what they've proposed for this second time.
You know, when they were negotiating the CBA, when they took every morning off for 4 months, they were probably too busy to talk about realignment during some of those 2 o'clock start day meetings.
Well, you can't expect meetings to start before 2 o'clock in the afternoon. I know that when I roll into the office at 2 o'clock in the afternoon, there's never any problem with that after I've been AWOL for the whole morning.
You know what? The league really is disorganized in many respects. I mean, I think Exhibit A is the Phoenix Coyotes not being owned by being owned by the league for upwards of 4 years, or close to 4 years. And I think, Drew,
how many years did Major League Baseball own the Montreal Expos for?
I don't recall.
I don't think it was 4 years, though.
I don't think it was either. But in any event, this is an issue that should have been getting more attention when the parties were all sitting together, because the PA needs to approve this. And again, I think they'll come to a resolution eventually, but why is this sitting over everybody, hanging over everybody's head? Why was this not dealt with at an earlier date.
Right, and Pierre LeBrun and Darren Drager said that it's going to be resolved in the next 2 weeks.
Right, here's and the okay, here's the proposed here's the four conferences that have been proposed. Conference A, which would have eight teams in it: Anaheim, Calgary, Colorado, Edmonton, Los Angeles, Phoenix, San Jose, and Vancouver. Pretty much the Mountain and Pacific time zone teams in the NHL. Conference B would feature the Winnipeg Jets, the Chicago Blackhawks, the Dallas Stars, the Minnesota Wild, and the St. Louis Blues, all of whom are Central Division time zones, and then three Eastern Division or Eastern time zones, that being Columbus, Nashville, and Detroit. So the Conference A and Conference B, both of whom would have eight teams per conference. Conference C would feature Boston and Buffalo, Florida and Tampa, Montreal, Ottawa, and Toronto, a seven-team conference. Conference D would feature Carolina, Washington, New Jersey, New York, Islanders, New York Rangers, Philly, and Pittsburgh, another seven-team conference. The question I have, as Ian, I'll let you start with this, is if they haven't resolved the inequities between an eight-team conference and a seven-team conference, isn't everything else just a moot point?
Yeah, and Richie mentioned
Richie's rolling his
eyes. Richie mentioned that they should have had this resolved, and this is hanging over their heads, and he's right. And I mean, the issues that persist are you have an uneven split. There's 30 teams, so when you go, you can't go 15 and 15, right? And that's, I guess, an issue. So there might be a playoff situation, but what needs to be resolved is Winnipeg needs to move out of the conference that they aren't supposed to be in. So they're going to move to the West. Everyone knows that. Who moves to the East? Is it going to be Columbus or Detroit?
Right, and now they're also not moving anybody.
Well, and eventually that's what those teams want. And the other issue with the conference that certain people reported, a team like Montreal, you mentioned, who's Montreal in the division with that stands out to you as far as where they wouldn't want to be in a division with? The Florida teams.
Yeah, but the Florida teams don't mind having a Montreal in there because the Snowbirds would fill up their arenas more than they typically would on a random game.
So those teams like it, but Montreal doesn't like it. Well, too bad. You have to make a decision eventually, right?
Well, Richie, what's the solution? Is the easiest solution here that they refuse to explore is just 3 5-team divisions per conference?
I don't really see the reason for blowing this all up. I mean, you swap two teams and you keep it the same, in my opinion. I don't know what's the big deal. Maybe Dallas is a team you can move over, and there's one or two teams you can be creative with. But in reality, you're going to have those problems regardless of the way it's all set up. And to set up an eight-team division and a seven-team division and then play a division-heavy schedule and then offer a crossover, well, that's not fair. Because a seven-team division, you know, there can be crossovers, but what if one division's way better than the other division? And then you can cross over from a weaker division into a stronger division? You know, and Michael points out, you know, Major League Baseball is moving to 2 15-team leagues. They're moving Houston Astros over because they want to have an equal shot. And that's that can point to exactly the opposite of what the NHL proposed in its last proposal for realignment. And that was an 18-division and a 17-division. So Major League Baseball, on the other hand, is saying, hey, we want 3 5-team divisions because we don't want everybody having an edge. And in hockey, they're moving towards a system that is not as equitable. And I just don't think this has been well thought out. And I know people think, and they may very well be correct, that Don Fehr and the players rejected the last realignment on the basis that it was teeing up for the lockout.
An opening salvo.
As opposed to the issues with that proposal. But I am of the belief that it was both.
Is the NHL too focused in when they look at realignment? Are they too focused, say, on time zones rather than geographic proximity? Because, Nashville is not far away from Carolina and Washington and would fit better in say, the current Southeast Division with Florida and Tampa, rather than being in a central time zone conference just because of the time zone factor. Nashville, if you look on the map, Nashville is a hell of a lot closer to Florida, Tampa, Washington, and Carolina than it is to Winnipeg, Chicago, and St. Louis.
To answer your question, yes, I think they are. They should look at time zones. But
no, I'm saying, Rich, should they look at geographics, geography, not time zones as much?
Well, again, I mean, teams should be with teams that are closest to them, period. Teams should be closer to teams who are geographically close to them. Time zones, I guess, are for more television purposes. But Richie mentioned equitable. And you guys might disagree with this, but in baseball, they wanted more teams. And if it's going to be a situation where they're going to have 9 versus 10 in a playoff, I think it's going to completely make the regular season even longer and less important than it already is. And that's why I think they shouldn't be looking at this like a chance to bring in more playoff teams, or they should be looking at this as an opportunity to move Winnipeg into the West and decide who they want to move into the East, and leave it at that.
Make no mistake, though. At the end of the day, you're dealing with politics here. You're dealing with the politics of ownership.
Sure.
And maybe trickling down a little bit to the president and such. Because you really have if you didn't have the Detroit Red Wings stirring the pot here, and understandably so, they want to get back into the East. They've done what they believe to be a good deed and a favor to Gary Bettman for the long haul here, and they want to get back. And you know what? It's going to be a little bit more of an issue now because Columbus, you know, where do they fit in? We've talked about this on Saturday's show before. Where does Columbus fit in vis-a-vis Detroit? You know, they're both in the Eastern time zone. They're both in the Western Conference. Columbus is trying to build up their brand. You know, do they shift to the East and have Winnipeg shift to the West? But then what about Detroit? That's where the politics comes in, because John McConnell, for all his goodwill, is no Mike Ilitch.
Well, and that's the problem, is that, I mean, if you're going to go strictly by time zones, the NHL has too many teams in the Eastern time zone that would want to be in the Eastern Conference as opposed to teams in the Central or Pacific or Mountain time zones that want to be in the Western Conference. It can't be equitable unless there's going to be a good soldier, like you mentioned that the Detroit Red Wings have been for all these many years.
A wild card here would be to have 6 5-team divisions, get rid of the conferences, have fairly equal playing field, meaning the teams play their divisions maybe once or twice more than the other teams. It's more travel, but then have all 30 teams ranked as one, and then you can get the crazy rivalry finals like Pittsburgh-Philly and Montreal-Toronto.
I'm not sure what the insistence is. I mean, a schedule is just a matrix done by a computer. So I'm not sure what the insistence is on these divisional rivalries and conference rivalries. You know when the biggest rivalries would be created? When Pittsburgh and Philly are killing each other in the Stanley Cup Finals. That would be the biggest rivalry of all time. Let's go to break. When we come back on NHL Midweek, the St. Louis Blues have the number one power play in the NHL. We're going to break it down for you and explain why they've been so successful. You're listening to TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mindell, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. Michael Remus is the producer of this fine show. The Illegal Curve Hockey Show, regular airing Saturday afternoon, 12 noon start time, where we will recap the Jets-Penguins game that will take place this coming Friday, and we'll preview the Jets-Bruins game that is going to take place later on Sunday afternoon.
I've got a lot to say about the Jets on Saturday already.
There you go. Richie's already fired up, and that's even before they play Friday night. So imagine if they lay an egg there as well. Richie will be guns a-blazing, so you can wait for that. Saturday afternoon, 12 noon, the Illegal Curve Hockey Show.
Break it down.
Break it down for this Wednesday evening. We'll focus on the power play of the St. Louis Blues. Fortunately, they happen to be on TV in the studio here, so we can, if they go to a power play, we can watch it at the same time. The St. Louis Blues have the top power play in the NHL so far this season. They're currently clicking at a 34.8% success rate. That is best in the NHL. Richie, they got two sort of solid five-man units, and the distinguishing feature on both of them is that each unit has a forward up on the point. Let's go through unit one to start with. TJ Oshie, David Perron, Alex Pietrangelo, Patrick Berglund, and David Backes. In that first unit, TJ Oshie is up at the point. Let's start with that first unit. What makes that first unit of the St. Louis Blues so successful?
I think when you talk about the St. Louis Blues power play, Drew, you have to look at it as 200 feet. Because, And Winnipeg Jets fan will know that when you cannot get into the zone and your zone entry is poor, you limit your chances. And the key to the Blues power play and the theme throughout this segment will be simplicity. The Blues get from behind their goal line, Ezzy, to the opposing blue line and over it so quickly and effortlessly. Now that is, for the most part, due to having two beautiful skaters on the back end quarterbacking both power plays. One is Alex Pietrangelo, and the other is Kevin Shattenkirk. And they both right-handed shooting guys who can skate like the wind. But they skate with such speed, and they get the puck in or they quarterback the play to get into the opposing team's zone, get into the offensive zone, and set up. So it's that breakout and that ability to easily enter the zone that gives them so much more zone time. And when you have more zone time, you know, the plays when you're on the power play, I mean, the Jets or whatever other team may have just as successful play in the offensive zone, but when you have less chances, you're obviously less successful.
Sure. If you can't set up, then it doesn't matter how good your plays are drawn up on a chalkboard if you can't even get to the point of being able to execute them.
Richie mentioned zone time, which is extremely important, and zone entry. In the Blues' last game, they lost to the Kings, but their one goal was on the power play. And if you look at that goal, it's funny. I know we're going to break it down a little bit more as far as formations go and personnel on the other units, but it was the second unit, and Alexander Steen got the goal. And it was a simple face-off back to Pietrangelo over to Steen for the shot, and it was a quick shot. But you mentioned simplicity, and these are key things, Richie, because oftentimes it's not necessarily the formation, although it can be. When teams are struggling, they'll try to do the overload, or like we talked about with Tampa last week, the 1-3-1 or the T. But it's also simplicity in your decision-making. And oftentimes, and Jets fans back to the days of Jets 1.0, and we've had talented players back to those days as well. I mean, we have Kane and Wheeler now, but we had Solani and Zamenhof back in the day. And we've had good defensemen on the point, like Phil Housley, just like we have Bufflin now. But it's simplicity in that you make your decision, you set one guy up, and then you stick with it. You don't pass the puck around for a minute of the power play and not get a shot off. And unfortunately, so far this year, even though it's early, we've seen too much of that.
One of the members of the same, we talked last week that there's sort of the quarterback power play. Who is the power play quarterback on that first unit for the St. Louis Blues? How do they align themselves, and why are they so effective?
Pietrangelo is really the quarterback on the power play. He'll line up on the blue line with TJ Oshie. But the key to them is they both move around a lot. And basically what happens is when the puck's on the, Pietrangelo will play the left side and Oshie will play the right side. But when the puck is on the strong side of the ice and they're playing on the weak side.
Side being the side that has three players on it?
Yeah, with the puck.
Right.
Either those players streak down the back door and they try and keep the other team honest. And what they kind of do is play, because they're streaking down all the time and moving a lot.
Streaking down means so coming down from the blue line, looking for, say, a backdoor pass.
Exactly.
Okay.
And what happens is when they do that, they kind of play a hybrid 1-3-1 because the Pietrangelo will invariably move to the middle of the ice to protect. When there's two guys on the point and one guy moves lower, the safeguard is to play in the middle, so you have an idea if you can cut down angles if the play goes the other way into your own zone. So what ends up happening is they kind of end up playing a 1-3-1 where Berglund is in the high slot. David Backes, whose presence is excellent in front of the net, screening, tipping, being hard body to move. And Perron playing on the half boards on the left side on his off wing. So the opposite of what we talked about last week with Marty St. Louis, who played on the off wing. He's a left-handed shooting guy. He played on the right side. Perron is a right-handed shooting player on the left side. So that's kind of how that first unit moves. But it's back to the idea of simplicity. Not only do they get great zone entry, and both units do this. They both get great zone entry. But the puck is in the zone. And it's pass, pass, shoot, or pass, shoot. There's no setting it up for the perfect play. And I'm assuming with the coaches that they have there in Hitchcock, like that puck gets off the stick so quick, and it doesn't have to be pretty. Shot, rebound, put it on the net, outnumber on the boards. It's amazing how they have three guys on the puck at all times against the other teams, two guys in the corner. The puck comes out, shots on net, drive the net. It's a simple power play.
And what you see is too many teams looking for a looking to put up and set up the pretty play. If more teams did what the Blues are doing, and I realize part of that is personnel, part of that is strategy. But if more teams simplified their game and watched what this team is doing, they would be more successful.
Could the Blues be this successful if it wasn't for the presence of David Backes in front of the net?
Maybe not as successful, but the second unit puts Chris Stewart in front of the net.
Exactly, and I was going to say, you know, just quickly jumping in here, that goal that Alex Steen scored on the point, you had Chris Stewart, who was 6'3", 230 pounds in front of the net. And, you know, just talking about the Blues' power play and... there's no reason to believe why they wouldn't be at the top for the rest of the year. There's so much skill there, but what they're doing is not only are they getting into the zone quickly and making quick decisions, they're putting guys in the positions that they should be in. And that's not to say that the Jets aren't, but I think the Jets still haven't found the right mix. And the problem, Richie, with the power play, because we've broken down Tampa and St. Louis, the two best power plays in the league. I'm not sure if Tampa's number two, but they're top five at least, and they were at start the season at the very least. But you've got so many talented players, and you don't necessarily have just the big shot from the point. Mm-hmm. I think the thing with the big shot from the point, whether it's Enstrom or Byfuglien for the Jets, is, I know we're breaking down the Blues power play, but just quickly to transition here, teams are going to quickly know that you're going to do that, and they're going to defend against that. They're going to put out their forward, whether it's, you know, a Ryan Callahan or a Jim Slater on the Jets, and they're going to block that shot every time.
Tampa's the number three power play in the NHL.
So they're
right
still
now.
Up there.
St. Louis number one, Tampa number three. We dealt with Tampa last week. Pittsburgh's in between them at number two. We'll see them Friday night here in Winnipeg. Unit two of the power play, the second power play unit for the St. Louis Blues. Kevin Shattenkirk, who you mentioned, and Alex Steen, they both are up on the point. Vladimir Tarasenko, the impressive rookie, is in the high slot, so sort of in the Steven Stamkos area that where he lines up for Tampa Bay. Andy McDonald is on the half boards, and Chris Stewart is in front of the net. You mentioned Chris Stewart earlier. Chris Stewart is an interesting guy. They acquired him from Colorado along with Shattenkirk in exchange for former first overall draft pick Eric Johnson.
Yep.
Chris Stewart looked like, I mean, he was a healthy scratch for a lot last year. He was really struggling. He's come back and is a lot and has really improved his game since last season. Unit two, same sort of strategy. Keep it simple. Throw the puck on the net.
Puck moves more through Alex Steen more than anybody else, and he plays on his off. He plays in the point on his off wing, so he's the left-handed shooting guy. He plays on the right side of the point. He's a good one-timer. Puts the puck on net. Smart player. He's really the key to that second unit. And you know, what a great trade that was for the Blues back then for Lee Stempniak. But that's how it works. Andy McDonald is a nice skater. You can move the puck. Tarasenko's dangerous in the high slot. But it's more so on that power play from the Shattenkirk, Steen are the driving forces behind there. But Steen doesn't get enough credit, as far as I'm concerned, in kind of running that second unit and running it very successfully.
And, Richie, I think you'd agree there's many things about this power play, like Tampa Bay, that you would be impressed by. And a couple of things. You mentioned the high slot. You've got Tarasenko, who is a front runner for Rookie of the Year right now in the high slot. And then you've also got Berglund in the high slot. Two skilled players, plus you've broken up your top two D for your point men, plus you've also put a forward on the point. So right now you've got three strengths, whereas a power play like the Jets right now, you probably say they've only got one, the big shots. And that's not to take anything away from Evander Kane or Alexander Burmistrov. I don't think that they've found the roles for those guys like the Blues have. And I think, you know, if they can, you know, and you copy something when it's good. I mean, Evander Kane and Alexander Burmistrov, even though they do play in the high slot, maybe it's a question of they're on the wrong wing and they need to focus more on that as opposed to just looking at the combinations. It's really not just about the line combinations. Obviously it is. It's about the personnel on there. I mean, it's necessarily where those people are.
If you want to quickly talk about the Jets, the key to them, and we'll break them down more on Saturday, is zone entry, and it's awful right now.
Yeah, it was atrocious. You don't need to be a hockey expert like we purport.
You don't have to worry about it. I'm in the zone. Every time we're on the radio, I'm in the zone.
We know that. The auto zone. You're listening to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. We'll be right back. 1 hour down, 1 hour to go. Welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're listening to TSN 1290. I'm your host, Drew Mandel. Joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, Michael Remus is our fine producer. Quick score update from in and around the NHL, being that it is a Wednesday night, that by default sort of means it's a quiet night in the NHL. At the end of one period in Pittsburgh, the Pittsburgh Penguins have a 1-0 lead on the Ottawa Senators. Pascal Dupuis, with his fifth of the year, assist to Sidney Crosby and Chris Kunitz. And in Detroit, where we were just talking about the St. Louis Blues, they haven't had any power play opportunities yet, but the Detroit Red Wings have a 2-0 lead on the Blues. Goals by Drew Miller, his first of the year for the Red Wings. And Ezzy, would you like to pronounce his name?
Thomas Tatar Sauce.
Yeah, exactly. Thomas Tatar.
Tatar Sauce, sorry.
Tatar Sauce, yeah. Thomas Tatar has the other goal.
Reem didn't see it. That's not going to catch on because Remus didn't find it funny.
Okay, well, anyways, it's Thomas Tatar has his first of the year for the Red Wings. 2-0 Detroit over St. Louis so far, about halfway through the first period in Detroit. Gentlemen, the big news, I guess early this morning, late last night, was that the Columbus Blue Jackets replaced Scott Housen, and they relieved him of his duties as general manager. And then earlier today, they made it official, hiring the first European general manager in the history of the NHL. Jarmo Kekäläinen
yep.
is the new general manager in Columbus. You know, it's hard to say that Scott Housen got a raw deal. In fact, I don't think anybody would argue that he got a raw deal. Are you surprised that John Davidson took this long to evaluate the situation?
No, not surprised that he took this long, Drew. You know, he really needed to. We had him on the show, and you could tell he needed to really take a close look at what the inner workings of the team. Not only the personnel on the ice, but off the ice. And I would have been very surprised if Housen was the GM for the draft. So to make this move now makes a lot of sense. And I don't mind that he had his successor, already lined up. Because it wasn't like a guy who was in Columbus's management room. Not that that's an issue necessarily with a guy like Nonis, but clearly they did their homework. He was over in Jokerit. He wasn't kind of stealing his job. It was a guy who was coming to the NHL, getting a great opportunity. I thought Davidson handled it in a classy manner, as he always seems to do. And I really like the step forward here and that it takes for, you know, to take a European born general manager, the first ever, and kind of make that announcement in a market that in reality, I mean, maybe it's the greatest, maybe it's the best market for him to break into, but I don't necessarily think that that is a factor. He's got a lot of guts, Davidson, because it's a risky hire in the lack of NHL general managing experience. He has experience in front offices, but you're bringing a guy over who hasn't been in an NHL office day to day, and you're giving him a team that needs to turn it around soon because they've essentially floundered for 10 years.
Well, the future of the franchise, the future of the Columbus Blue Jackets could very easily be foretold depending on what happens with their drafting this year. Like you
yep.
said, three first-round draft picks.
Three.
They have their own. They have the one they acquired from Los Angeles, and they have the one that they acquired from Philadelphia, if
yep.
I'm not mistaken. Exactly.
Yep. So good memory.
Thank you. Kekäläinen certainly can quickly leave his mark on this team. Ezzy, you know, this is a guy who's been around. He was in the Ottawa organization. He was with John Davidson in the St. Louis organization. You know, yes, it's a little bit of an out there hire because he's European, but this isn't a guy who doesn't know his way around the NHL.
Absolutely. He was director of amateur scouting for 10 years and with St. Louis. And what Aaron Portsline of the Columbus Dispatch mentioned today is if you look at the 2007 draft, and St. Louis had three first-rounders. And I hope I remember who the draft picks were. It was Ian Cole was one of them. And one of them was traded. Now I'm losing. I know Ian Cole was one of them. There was another another two good ones. Not Berglund.
Drew's going to treat.
If you can look it up, what Portsline mentioned today was that in a similar situation in St. Louis, Kekäläinen was responsible for three first-rounders in the 2007 draft.
Well, you know,
and that's a huge reason why he was appointed GM because of his pedigree with drafting players and having a good eye for talent. Drew?
2007, Lars Eller selected by the St. Louis Blues 13th overall. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that turned into Yaroslav Halak from the Montreal Canadiens. So you can say that's a win in terms of a draft pick right there. The next one is Ian Cole. He was selected 18th overall. Less of a win, and I would suggest there.
Yep.
And then 26th overall, the Blues selected David Perron.
Perron is the guy. I only remembered one out of three. That shows you how good my memory is. But the point Portsline was making is that he has a good eye for talent. But Richie mentioned this already. Davidson knew that Kekalainen was the guy he was going to bring in if he was going to let Scott Housen go. It is a risky move in the sense that he doesn't have the general manager experience. But, you know, with the picks coming up, this team is now going in a completely different direction. Talk about rebuild. I mean,
necessary. I don't know him. Kekalainen, based on his pedigree and based on the people you speak to, I like the hire. I think it's a good hire. I think it's a smart hire. I think another thing to note is if you speak to some people around the game, they'll tell you that Columbus's presence in Europe was close to nothing.
Yeah.
Was next to nil, as they say. And for an organization that needs to be drafting, be drafting really well to compete on an annual basis, turning a blind eye to Europe, which they apparently did, is really limiting your ability to turn it around.
Ask Detroit what happens if you do that.
I gotta throw a flag on the play. Bob McKenzie on Twitter. Just tweeted the following 7 seconds ago. Hearing rumors of Alexei Ponikarovsky's trade out of Winnipeg. New Jersey Devils, perhaps. He's checking.
Well, he's been there before.
We'll bring that to you in the next 50 minutes if something comes on that front. Again, repeating, Bob McKenzie reporting that he's hearing rumors that Alexei Ponikarovsky has been traded out of Winnipeg. Nothing confirmed as of yet, but we'll keep bring that to you right away as soon as we know anything. Continue on here.
Well, I hope that's the last time I ever get broken into because Alexei Ponikarovsky was traded.
Not yet.
I'm kidding.
Hey, Richie, don't you remember the time that I woke you up? It was 3 a.m. to tell you that Alexei Ponikarovsky had signed with the Jets. You don't remember that?
But back, I know people are going to want to talk about that, and we will talk about that once we get more details, and that may be a product of Eric Tangrady being acquired by the Winnipeg Jets earlier today. But, you know, back to the Columbus situation, I want to switch over to Scott Housen. And I think Scott Housen, he's a nice guy. I've had the opportunity to meet him before. He's a class act, but he didn't do the job. And at the end of the day, it's a results-oriented business, as you say all the time, Drew, and he didn't get results. And if there was one trade that I think is a metaphor for his period in Columbus, it has to be the Jeff Carter trade. Mm-hmm. It has to be not knowing that Jeff Carter would be willing. And Jeff Carter, you could argue, sandbag a bit there, but didn't do enough research and whatever the reason was, that Jeff Carter was not going to take on playing in Columbus with a positive attitude. And so what happened was he traded, as Jets fans got to see in person last night, a player who's really developed year after year into a real nice player, Jakub Voracek. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the pick that ended up being another player that Winnipeg Jets fans like to talk about a lot, Sean Couturier. And that resulted in Jeff Carter being traded near the end of last season and the Columbus getting Jack Johnson. If that is a metaphor, to me that's a metaphor for Scotty Housen's tenure in Columbus. And it's unfortunate. He's a class act, but he didn't deserve to stay there any longer. John Davidson had to make that move.
Richie, you mentioned earlier about the European talent on the Columbus Blue Jackets and Kekalainen and probably having an advantage in that he will help with that and has an experience in the past with that. And also John Davidson, in the beginning, was hired as the president, and we haven't even mentioned this at all today. They need to also attract free agents going forward.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously,
yeah.
They've got Ryan Murray and Jack Johnson, a lot of talent on defense, and then you've started to rebuild with Dubinsky and Anisimov coming over for Nash. But later on, you're going to have to start to attract free agents, and they've had issues with that.
Mm-hmm.
No offense to James Wisniewski, they were lucky to get Jeff Carter, but You're not exactly attracting Ryan Suter and Zach Parise here, and they're going to have to start to do that.
He really didn't demonstrate an ability to compete with the other 30 general managers, and he may very well settle into a nice assistant general manager role like he had in Edmonton before he got that opportunity. But if you kind of look back at it, you know, the Oilers had that nice run into the finals there. And Howson benefited from that. And you see how the Oilers fared after that. Howson kind of fared the same way, didn't he?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. Quickly before we go to break, an interesting point of reference if you want to talk Finnish hockey. Teemu Selänne, Teppo Numminen, and the new general manager there in Columbus, Jarmo Kekalainen, all born on July 3rd. All have the same birthday. So apparently if you want to be a hockey player from Finland or a hockey executive from Finland, July 3rd is the day that you should be born. You're listening to NHL Midweek. We're on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek here on TSN 1290. We can now confirm a report from Bob McKenzie that Winnipeg has traded Alexei Ponikarovsky to the New Jersey Devils. What is coming back to Winnipeg is not yet known, but we will have that for you ASAP. One more time, Bob McKenzie of TSN reporting that the New Jersey Devils have reacquired Alexei Ponikarovsky from the Winnipeg Jets. Guys, I think we'd be remiss if we didn't take a moment now to really reflect back on our favorite memories of the Alexei Ponikarovsky era.
Well,
I think it was the game that he was invisible for myself. That's the one that jumps out at me the most.
Which one?
Exactly my point.
I thought the highlight of Alexei Ponikarovsky's career in Winnipeg was when the Jets signed him and we were out for a couple of beers on a Saturday afternoon after doing the July 1st free agent special. And as he called his dad excitedly and said, you know, the Jets have signed Ponikarovsky. And his dad's reply, order the rings.
Well, I think aside from the fact that he had 4 points in 12 games, Richie, and only played here for 12 games, I think the fact is that he didn't add secondary scoring. He didn't add much of a physical presence. This might have something to do with the fact that Dania Zubris, who Matty Loughlin mentioned, isn't going to be in the lineup for a while. He's another big guy and has been underachieving. We don't know yet who they got, but Jets management isn't happy. They made a trade and got Eric Tangrady today for a seventh rounder, and now they're moving Ponikarovsky, who they obviously weren't happy with. So we'll have to wait and see who they got. But one thing's for sure, his tenure in Winnipeg was short and terrible.
Fourth round pick in 2014 and a seventh round pick in 2013.
So they got so the seventh round pick.
They get the seventh round pick back that they traded for Tangrady, and they get a fourth round pick, not this year, but next year. So
I just don't understand why, you know, Ponikarovsky, I'm assuming, as what we had heard, wanted to stay in New Jersey. New Jersey didn't offer him, I assume, the same money the Jets offered him.
But now they have more money to...
Now they acquired him. I never really understand that. The Jets end up with a fourth-round pick, who you never know, and Tangrady, who, hey, you never know. You know what Ponikarovsky is. You probably know what Tangrady is. You give it a shot. Let's not overanalyze a bunch of lower-end players being acquired here. Pittsburgh is a very astute... the Pittsburgh organization is very astute at analyzing talent, so you're always a little bit skeptical when they let somebody go for virtually nothing.
Yeah, Richie, Tangrady is 24 years old, so he's obviously quite a bit younger than Ponikarovsky, who I believe is 29 or 30. But he's a guy that was up and down from Wilkes-Barre Scranton on countless occasions, most notably to play with Evgeny Malkin when there were injuries on the wings. He's a winger. And it's a situation where, you know what, Ponikarovsky isn't giving you goals. He's not giving you physicality. And Tangrady might do that. And that's really what it's about. It's about making a change. It's not about making change for the sake of change. I think what you're trying to do is you're basically getting a guy out of there. I mean, like you said, you turn it into a fourth rounder. Ponikarovsky did very little when he was on the ice.
I mean, Ponikarovsky is what he is. He was exactly what they expected, I'd assume. So why they signed him, maybe to turn him into something, okay, fine. But we said it on the show last week, on Saturday, this past Saturday. If they're going to be trading these guys, Ponikarovsky, Wellwood, and Atropov, are they getting anything more than a fourth? There you go. They didn't get anything more than a fourth.
A fourth and the equivalent of an unsigned free agent in the seventh-round draft pick.
Even fifths are arguably, I've looked at the numbers, even fifths are arguably the same as a seventh, which is the same as an undrafted free agent. So I think the fourth is really your cutoff point of value. There are exceptions to that rule, as there are to every rule.
Yep.
But overall, I mean, the fourth is kind of the cutoff point. But the third ones have a little bit of currency, second more so, and obviously your firsts.
One more time, the New Jersey Devils have acquired Alexei Ponikarovsky from the Winnipeg Jets. In exchange, the Winnipeg Jets receive a 2013 seventh-round pick from the Devils and a 2014 fourth-round pick. So, you know, take that for what it's worth.
Well, I have nothing else to say.
Yeah, I know. I might as well. Let's go for the. You ready for six things now, Rima?
Rima, stop looking at your sushi order.
Six things we learned this week.
Commence countdown. Six.
The first thing we learned this week, what the value is of Alexei Ponikarovsky, but anyways, Richie, you can start it off. The Detroit Red Wings are as good or better than any team at creating speed in the neutral zone.
It's really something to watch how quickly, you know, and that's partly a product of just overall speed, but it's also the way they strategize and they curl their guys back and they're able to get so much speed through the neutral zone that they pressure the opposing team and always have the option of carrying in or dumping it in. And I think that's hard to match. And again, speed through the neutral zone, speed kills the pressure on the other team that they create of essentially nothing. And I think it's also important to note, because you don't have Lidstrom there anymore, you don't have Rafalski there anymore. As Kenny Holland said in our Saturday show a couple weeks ago, those are big holes to fill. But they're filling it in different ways. It's support up the middle. It's supporting the defenseman with speed and putting guys a little closer than they might have before. But just really well-coached team. And if you look at the small details of a Detroit squad, Mike Babcock, is as good as any at making adjustments.
Five. Ezra Ginsberg. Dougie Hamilton is having a superb rookie season for the Boston Bruins.
I know Richie's going to love this one. But Dougie Hamilton, you look at his stats, and he's only got 4 points in 10 games. But he's playing big minutes. He's now averaging somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 and a half, 19 minutes. He's a big guy playing as a 19-year-old, and he's doing a very good job. Right now, he's paired with Dennis Seidenberg, and he hasn't got his first NHL goal yet, he's really doing a good job. He's going to be a shutdown guy, and I really like the way he plays, and he does the simple things that maybe not everyone and notices and doesn't get you on the score sheet at the end of the night, but he's very intelligent and he does small things really well. And if everyone remembers the game that the Jets played in Boston, Dougie Hamilton now gets a little bit of power play time and he is quickly gaining the confidence of Julien, and it's great to see.
It's hard to gain. Julien isn't quick to trust young players. They have to earn his trust. If Hamilton develops defensively as good as he is offensively, he'll be a superstar defenseman.
Yep.
And one other thing, Drew, people always talk about Couturier.
Yep.
Jets passed him.
On many mock drafts, he was actually ahead of Couturier. Yep. And Scheifele.
He was 11th, I believe. 10th or 11th.
Yeah,
Hamilton.
And he would also look great in the Toronto Maple Leafs uniform.
Drafted
also.
9th, I believe.
Or 9th.
Yeah.
Well, I was one off.
Four.
When you're only one off, we're usually doing okay with you in that case.
Usually I'm more than one marble
off. That was my point. Richie, if the Buffalo Sabres are going anywhere this season, they will need Tyler Myers to find his game.
Watching a fair bit of Buffalo Sabres play lately, and this team, he was a healthy scratch for a couple games in a row, but this team cannot do anything unless they have Tyler Myers going. Their defense is just not good enough, Drew. And they have some of the smaller guys. And, you know, a guy like, when your top pairing is Christian Ehrhoff and Alex Sulzer, you are not going to be able to compete with the other teams on a nightly basis. And Christian Ehrhoff.
Case in point, Boston beating them the other night.
Yeah, well, Boston beating them, watching that game. And, you know, their second pairing is Regier, who's not the same player as he was, although I think a guy like him would really look good on the Jets, as an aside. Andreas Sequeira, who I actually like. And then your third pairing is Jordan Leopold. You know, he's always unpredictable in what he'll give you. You know baseline, but you don't know if he'll actually elevate his game, which he's capable of at times. And then Mike Weber. But that's six. I mean, that can't do it, guys. That can't do it in the Eastern Conference. That can't do it in the Western Conference. Tyler Myers not only needs to come back and push one of those guys out of the lineup, he needs to come back and be a top four minimum, a top four defenseman. Because that team with that six-man unit or Myers playing in that unit at a low level cannot... probably won't even make the playoffs.
Three.
Ezzy, Alexander Ovechkin is finally adjusting to the switch over to the right wing, and playing with Mike Ribeiro is complementing his game. He's also learning some fancy new ways to whine.
Absolutely. Mike Ribeiro has been absolutely on fire lately. And Alexander Ovechkin, for example, was starting the season playing with Joey Crabbe and Jay Beagle. Nothing against Joey Crabbe or Jay Beagle, but when you're playing with Mike Ribeiro, you can say that it's a bit of an improvement. Now, Alexander Ovechkin started off the season on right wing under Adam Oates, new coach, and it didn't work out, and he started off slow, and it's still fairly early. But in the last few games, his shots are up, his point totals are up. I think he's only still got, I think he's still 8 or 9 points, but his point totals are up. But Alexander Ovechkin now is finding new ways to reinvent himself. And Alexander Ovechkin, when he came into the league, everyone knows what he was doing. He was scoring highlight goals every night of the week, and defensemen were quickly learning how to close those gaps and take away his moves, which a lot of the time it was cutting through to the middle for that quick release shot. Alexander Ovechkin now on the right wing, he's a right-handed shot, is now he's being forced to find other ways to score. And now he's adjusting. And now the Capitals, even though they're still way out of a playoff spot right now in the Eastern Conference, they're starting to play better. Because Ribeiro, you know what Ribeiro, he's a great playmaker. He's got lots of great hands and skill. But Ovechkin is now finally adjusting to that right side, and the team's playing better. And I still think Washington, even though they're out of it right now, they're too good to not be a playoff team.
Richard Pollock, if P.K. Subban is to take that next step, he is going to have to involve his teammates in his offensive play, especially when breaking down the ice.
He'll streak down the ice, and he's a great skater, and he's a good stick handler, and he has some vision. But too many times he streaks down that wing or down the side of the ice through the neutral zone with his head down into the offensive zone and doesn't make the pass when it needs to be made. And if you can't make that pass, or you don't involve your teammates after a while, they don't expect to be involved. That's never a good thing. You don't want the apathetic line mates out there with you. But also, if he's going to take the next step, you know, he gets talked about for Team Canada. Can he skate at the Olympic level? For sure. Can he shoot at the Olympic level? Yeah. And can he handle the puck? Yes. But can he involve his teammates? Can he conserve some energy by playing smart? And right now, I just don't see that in his game. And he's still short of that next level.
Ezzy, Jiří Tlustý is finally developing into a first-line winger and can play a huge role in helping Carolina get back into the playoffs this year.
Absolutely.
And was there a pun there with huge role given his nude photo scandal from Toronto?
And that's the naked truth.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you. There you go.
That's a few years back that happened. Yeah, I almost want to say we were on Kick FM when that happened.
Some things you can't unsee.
Absolutely. Yeah, unfortunately, I never took a look at those pictures. But Jiří Tlustý, people forget, was a first-round pick of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and they gave him the opportunity to play for a couple of years, and he bounced in and out of the lineup, and he was inconsistent. But now it so happens that he's playing with Eric Staal on the top line. And I am a big fan of Jiří Tlustý, and I think he offers a lot of speed on the wings, and he's contributing now, and he got a couple of goals the other night, and that's what the Carolina Hurricanes are gonna need. Richie and I argued about this earlier on in the season. You know, they've got a young defense, unproven defense, not too many superstar names back there after, if you want to consider Joni Pikkanen and Joe Corvo superstar names, but like Justin Falk, but Jiří Tlustý is playing very well right now, and I think this is the year. I think he's going to prove everyone that he can put it together for a whole season.
Let's go to break. That was six things we learned this week. Coming up in 15 minutes' time, we're going to carry Kevin Sheveldayoff's media conference about the Alexei Ponikarovsky trade. You can hear that here live on TSN 1290. Let's go to break. You're listening to NHL Midweek on TSN 1290. Welcome back to NHL Midweek. Here on TSN 1290, I'm your host, Drew Mandel, joined in studio by Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg. We're going to be bringing you the media conference regarding the Alexei Ponikarovsky trade in about 10 minutes' time. Until then, we're going to learn about the prospects of the Philadelphia Flyers.
Prospect Pulse.
Prospect Pulse means we bring in the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey, Kyle Kozier. Kyle, how are you, buddy?
Hey, I'm very well. Thanks for calling, guys.
As always, Kyle. The Philadelphia Flyers are not one of the deepest prospect systems in the NHL. In fact, according to our friends at Hockey's Future, they're ranked as the 30th best prospect system. But that's not to say that they don't have some people worth talking about. So, Kyle, that's why we have you on. And I want to start with a goaltender. A goaltender. out of the North American Hockey League, a guy named Anthony Stolarz. He was a draft pick of the Flyers. You know, the Flyers and goaltending usually are synonymous and go hand-to-hand. What can you tell us about Anthony Stolarz and his future with the Philadelphia Flyers?
Well, I tell you, I just really want to comment very, very briefly on the Flyers. I think they're somewhat unfairly judged. You know, Paul Holmgren does a pretty nice job of pulling guys in from all over the place, you know, whether it be junior A or college or, you know, unsigned guys out of major junior. You know, he's willing to give almost anybody a try. It looks like they can play, and that sort of brings us to Stolarz. Great big kid. He's 6'5". He's one of those, I guess, that new wave of you know, super tall goalies that the Flyers are willing to take a flyer on, I guess, unintentional, out of the North American League. He played with Corpus Christi, put up really big numbers there, and got a lot of attention, you know, sort of as the season went on in the North American League, which is, you know, often scouted pretty heavily early, and then in the playoffs they have a showcase down in just outside of, well, I guess in Minneapolis in September, you know, where a lot of guys are seen initially. It's very heavily attended by scouts, and obviously got somebody's attention there, and, you know, as the season progressed, Stolarz got, you know, quite a bit better. That said, it's still sort of a surprise when his name was called as a draft. I remember sitting there and people were looking around like, ooh, 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 you know, so kind of an interesting deal. He's moved on to college now, playing at Omaha, where, you know, under Dean Blaze. So good program there, another sort of program that's willing to give, you know, give chances to some guys that are sort of outside the sort of the traditional hockey pipeline. So, again, with his size, he sort of figures to be, you know, I guess a current comparable, somebody like Kevin Dubnyk of the Oilers, that, you know, real tall kid, you know, moves fairly well, but all the same, you really can't teach the size. So just his natural physical stature covers a lot of net. And so you combine that with a little bit of athleticism, and apparently he's got a, you know, very big competitive streak, which also goes a long way. So it could be hopefully a goaltender for the future of the Flyers, and you know, maybe people can stop talking about where their next goalie's coming from.
Kyle, Michael Parks is a guy that puts a UND product, seen him play.
Yeah.
You know, when you think of the Flyers, sometimes you think, oh, big, mean. In my limited time seeing him a couple times, didn't seem to be that kind of a player, more of a skilled player. Can you talk about his game?
Yeah, you know, that's a guy that's really kind of an intriguing guy, you know, sort of mid-round pick, I think a fourth or fifth round, if I remember right. He's from St. Louis. He played in the, you know, the AAA system in St. Louis, moved on, played with the Cedar Rapids team in the USHL, and then on to UND here, too. So, you know, I sort of have the benefit of getting to watch these guys practice. And he's a kid that you think should be a real big contributor. Big kid. He's got good hands. He's a streaky scorer. Saw him recently against Wisconsin, scored two real nice, I guess, those sort of typical power forward goals. But then again, will disappear for stretches at a time. And, you know, maybe one of those guys that really doesn't realize, you know, he's 6'2 and close to 200 pounds and just might not realize he has a pretty big frame that he could, you know, bring to bear if he wanted to. So, again, more of a project at this point, you know, not quite the prospect, but the project. If you can put it all together, that might be a good winger for them. That said, he's got to get some stuff figured out. You know, he had pretty good numbers, I think about 12 goals last year as a freshman at UND. So, you know, pretty decent in the WCHA, but, you know, that might be a guy that, you know, we'll see what he does, you know, here as a sophomore, of course, as a junior, and I'd imagine he stays in college the whole time because there's a lot of sort of similar players in the Flyer system. But certainly an interesting guy to keep an eye on. You never know how those could be your form of late bloomers, too.
KK, I have to ask you about this guy because, well, simply, you know I'm a sucker for names, and his name is amazing. Shane Gostis Be Here. He's a defenseman, and I probably mispronounced that because, I don't know, it's a tough name. He plays for the Union College. He's a defenseman, American defenseman. What can you tell us about his game?
Again, really sort of an interesting guy. You know, hails from Florida, you know, played in that system there, went to, you know, sort of a smaller college, Knox Union, typically higher ranked, but again, sort of a small, out-of-the-way school out in New York there. Really kind of progressed his way through the USA camp, had a pretty impressive showing as a freshman, was, you know, if you recall from the World Juniors this year, was impressive there, continues to do well at Union this year. And I can't recall the connection, but there is a Flyers connection at Union College. And so it's one of those guys where they sort of had a little bit of inside information. You know, he's not super big. He's about 5'11", but, you know, skates very well, distributes the puck well, has some offensive upside there, too. So that's kind of a nice find for them is a, you know, I think a third-round pick, a guy that sort of, you know, I guess they do the draft over again today, might go a lot higher than where he was selected. So, again, you know, doesn't really bring the size of the physical presence that, you know, you see with a lot of other Flyer defensemen, but he does certainly have those puck-moving skills.
We're talking about the Philadelphia Flyers prospects with the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey, Kyle Kozier. Kyle, here's a guy who's got a very, he's got a last name that everybody recognizes, and that's Kessel. His first name is Blake. He's Phil's little brother. He's a defenseman in the Flyers organization. Does he have the upside of his brother?
Well, you know, at one time he did. He's actually, you know, as the younger brother, he's about 6'2 and, you know, close to 200 pounds. A lot bigger than Phil, obviously. But he sort of, I guess, tailed off as a prospect somewhat. You know, he had his typical progression was, you know, he had a pretty good first year at USHL, then was lights out the second year. Pretty good first year at New Hampshire, lights out the second year. His last 2 years of college, the production tailed off a little bit. You know, he was originally an Islanders draft pick. The flight, you know, he waited, you know, under the old TBA, kind of waited his time out, wasn't signed by the Islanders, signed with the Flyers as a free agent. And again, I think in the hopes that he would be sort of that the next offensive defenseman there. But it's tailed off to the point where he's playing in the East Coast League. Now, again, his 89 birthday, pretty, you know, and as a defenseman, it's a little early to write a guy off. Just hasn't been exactly what they hoped. So I would say the upside is still there. It just seems to me might sort of have, a little bit of trouble adjusting to the speed of the pro game. And I think that might be a case where there was a guy that was always the best player, always the best athlete on the ice, you know, really wasn't pushed a lot until he got to the pro level and just having trouble making that adjustment.
Kyle, you know, the Flyers as a whole, I'm kind of interested in the organizational philosophy. Do you see them moving towards more of a college-based drafting system? Maybe not college-centric, but based upon their kind of aversion to the college game it appeared for many years, are they making some inroads that way?
You know, in part. I think where they're really doing a nice job, and this is, I guess on the college side too, is they are very actively mining, you know, the collegiate ranks for possible free agents. You know, they got trying to think of the kid's name, is signed as a free agent out of Brown. It'll come to me in a minute. They had Andrew Johnson, who played in the Saskatchewan Junior League, was signed right out of the SJHL, was bound for Union. They plucked him out of there. You know, a lot of kind of different guys like that. But, you know, backing off of the college thing a little bit, they're also going out and signing a lot of, you know, undrafted 20-year-olds out of the CHL, which is kind of interesting, too. Guys that, you know, had especially some element they saw that could make him into an NHL player. So really kind of an interesting thing there, and I think that might be a reflection of, you know, for a lot of years they were big on trading draft picks and that kind of thing. So they really got quite creative with going, you know, looking for these other guys. And I guess back on the college thing for a bit, there's actually a Division III goaltender playing in, you might be familiar with the school in Minnesota, Gustavus Adolphus.
Mm-hmm.
6'8", big, lanky kid. And apparently the Flyers have some interest in his. So that's not really your typical route to the NHL. You know, a Division III goaltender, typically, you know, you go there, you play a little hockey, get a good education, but, you know, usually the NHL doesn't come calling. So, again, as I mentioned on the top of the thing, the Flyers are really doing a pretty good job of, you know, leaving no stone unturned that way. And, of course, that includes both college and junior. And, a lot of kind of interesting things that way, too. I guess another prospect they have in terms of drafting is that Peter Plotchek, who went from Hotchkiss Prep, right from prep school to Harvard, and, you know, doing okay there, too. So really looking at some interesting type of prospects. Not your, you know, they don't seem to have a typical philosophy of, like, oh, you know, we like WHL guys, mm-hmm. we like college guys only. Like, they're out there looking for players wherever they can find them.
Kyle Kozier is the director of amateur scouting for Veritas Hockey. Thanks always for joining us and breaking down the Flyers' prospects for us.
Josh, anytime, guys. I enjoy it.
Take care,
a lot,
Kyle.
KK.
Thanks very much.
Thanks. Yeah, bye.
Quickly, in Ottawa, Erik Karlsson was just helped off the ice. It looked like it could have either been a knee or he took a skate blade to the back of the leg. He put absolutely no pressure, no weight on the leg whatsoever. So that could be, well, that could just be a disaster of epic disasters for the Ottawa Senators. It did not look good. My first thought was ACL. So we'll see if we can give it to you in the next 15 minutes. We'll give you an update.
And Dr. Drew.
Dr. Drew, exactly right. Let's go to break. When we come back, Kevin Cheveldayoff on the Alexei Ponikarovsky trade. You're listening to TSN 1290. Shortly after 7:45 in the evening, welcome back to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. We are awaiting a news conference featuring Winnipeg Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff. because Alexei Ponikarovsky was traded to the New Jersey Devils about 45 minutes ago, give or take. In exchange for Alexei Ponikarovsky, the Winnipeg Jets receive a 7th-round draft pick and a 4th-round draft pick, the 7th-round draft pick this year, the 4th-round draft pick next year. Let's go live to that media availability.
Explain the reasoning of moving Ponikarovsky, just point blank.
Well, I think the reason is that we earlier in the day we acquired Eric Tangredi from the Pittsburgh Penguins today, and you know, he's a player that you know, has gone through the development cycle in the Pittsburgh organization, and was someone that you know, had some opportunities to play within their system, but within our group, our scouting staff, you know, knowing that. You know, he is someone that either had to fit into their lineup or would have to be moved. You know, identified him. We went out and acquired him. And upon acquiring him, you know, we had the opportunity to open up some roster space and some ice time for him. He's 24 years old, and you know, we're very hopeful that he is someone that. Given an opportunity to play within our organization, is going to blossom and continue to move forward. So it was really more about creating an opening and an opportunity for Eric as opposed to anything with Alexei.
How do you summarize the short time that Ponikarovsky was here?
Well, I think, you know, short time is certainly the correct term. I think that this season... you know, every game is magnified to the point, though, where while the time frame might be compressed, each and every game, you know, has a greater magnitude. And so we had to make some decisions, and, you know, I've been had the opportunity to see the majority of the games of our team play, talking to our coaches, and obviously trying to look at a long-term, you know, plan to continue to get better as an organization. You know, the opportunity to make these moves today is something that we're hopeful will grow into something great.
Kevin Paul Friesen, the Winnipeg Sun. Were you then making these deals kind of parallel at the same time, or one first and then you needed to make room for Tangredi?
Well, it was kind of the conversations that these things, you know, sometimes take different turns of event. You know, we've been talking over a couple of days, you know, certainly on the Tangredi deal, but, you know, how the other things laid out, you know, really just started to take fruition. As the deal was being announced, obviously with New Jersey having their issues with some injuries and stuff like that, that it did make things work for both sides.
Looking back, me again, Paul, looking back then at the Ponikarovsky signing, any reason to not call it a swing and a miss in free agency?
Well, you know, again, I think that you know, if you're worried about taking swings and missing, you know, you're not going to get up to the plate. You have to try and do some things, and you know, again, there's different reasons. You know, obviously, why guys are available, age, opportunities. You know, teams looking to, you know, use younger players within their organization. So, free agency is a time where you look at what's available, you try to fit some needs. Some of them fit, some of them don't. And, you know, again, you know, Alexei is someone that, you know, we wish all the best. So, you know, as far as, you know, looking at anything other than, you know, bringing him into our organization, evaluating him, finding something that, you know, our scouts hope will grow into something, and acquiring an asset in the equation is something that I would look at for any player, irrespective of signing, you know, now or you know, as a free agent or, you know, in the future.
Chevy, Drew Mindell from the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. You're live on TSN 1290 right now. In the offseason, did you offer Alexei Ponikarovsky more money to come to Winnipeg than the Devils had offered him during the same free agency period?
That I really don't know.
Hi, Kevin. This is John Chidley Hill with the Canadian Press. I was wondering, going forward, what kind of role or what are you hoping to expect from Tangredi for the rest of the season?
Well, You know, we opened up a third line opportunity here with the moving of Ponikarovsky, and Eric will get an opportunity to slide into that position at this point in time. But again, it's a constant evaluation with a lot of different players or all different players on the roster. So. That's the hole that was created with the move, and we're going to give Eric an opportunity to grow into it. He's he's a big player. He's someone that former second round draft pick that had a very good junior career, had a very good American Hockey League career, and a lot of these players that move into the National Hockey League and find their way do so because they're given opportunities, and sometimes it's not within the organizations that that develop them.
Thanks, Kevin.
Sean Reynolds from CBC Winnipeg. I'm wondering, is there a message in this for the rest of the team?
Well, I think the message is that we're constantly going to try and get better, and we're constantly going to try and grow in whatever way that we can, be it in acquisition of assets or if opportunities present themselves. We'll look at a lot of different things. It's a good group. We have to find our way a little bit. It's still a very inconsistent group, if we can acquire players that will own for periods of time that can grow and fit into our lineup and our system, that's the only way that you can get stability. And, it's something that through the draft process we hope will continue to develop our organization. But if I can, accelerate the process at any step, be it, a small step or a large step, we're going to look at that.
How about the timing of this? Is this meant to shake anything up?
It's not one of those things where you sit back and say I got to do a deal to make a deal. There's conversations that go on with general managers daily, and sometimes they lead to something, sometimes they don't, and it takes two teams to make a deal happen. And in this situation here, both organizations, the Penguins and the Devils, we're looking to make a deal as well.
Those daily conversations with other general managers, is there anything else in the work that we can expect?
Well, again, there'll be lots of conversations. Those are going to continue, to happen. And, it's a constant evaluation process. No one should be sitting here on my team, thinking, oh, my goodness, I'm the next guy to go. But in the same token, they all should be sitting there saying, this organization wants to continue to get better and is going to try and make steps to do that.
It's Paul Friesen again, Kevin. Do you have any untouchable players on your roster?
Well, I don't know that anybody's untouchable. Certainly there's guys with, trade restrictions and different things like that. But we do want to create an aura of stability. And in order to do that, you commit to some players long term and you let them continue to grow and you bring in other players that hopefully will be around with you for many, many years. So I'm not a guy that sits here and threatens to trade anyone, but at the end of the day, we're looking at the big picture. The big picture is down the road, we're going to look at all different aspects to try and attain our goal.
And why do you think Grady has not established himself so far in his career, from what you've seen and your scouts tell you?
Well, I think that he is someone that is a player that needs to be given an opportunity to feel comfortable. And for so many young players, it's very, very hard to break in. They play a certain role at the at the lower levels. Certainly at junior, they're dominant players. They get to the American League, they're around better players, more seasoned players, and sometimes their roles are one thing there. When they get to the National Hockey League, it's even tougher to break in and play that role. Sometimes you have to be afforded an opportunity to grow into it and feel comfortable. And it's a difficult process because it takes patience. And sometimes the rewards don't get reaped for a period of time. But sometimes success is just one step past failure.
Sean Reynolds with CBC again. Having said that, and having said that, an opportunity has opened up here on the third line. How confident are you that Tangredi is ready to step into that role and flourish and succeed?
Well, that'll happen over time. You know, like the evaluation process will continue, again, we're not sitting here, obviously guaranteeing anything. It is a game. It is something that is ever moving and evolving. But all you can do is have faith in players and give them opportunities to grow. And the coaching staff will have to do some teaching, some mentoring, some development as well. But if you want young players to come into your system, you have to find a way to give them that opportunity.
So what then is the backup plan if that doesn't work out?
Well, the backup plan is you're always constantly having conversations, and you know, again, these things, you don't know what's going to happen. We do have assets that we've acquired. We have numerous draft picks both this year and certainly now next year. And, again, whether we draft all those players or we use some of those players down the line to acquire, other players, those are all things that remain to be seen.
Anything else, guys? Kevin, can you just give us a quick word as you're one quarter of the way through this shortened season, where you feel your hockey club's at right now?
Well, we're right around 500. We're one below that, and that's probably how we've played. We've had some glimpses of things that are really good, and we've had some things that you'd like to improve. I think talking around to a lot of the different general managers, there's a lot of frustration, I think, in a lot of different teams for some inconsistencies and some teams that maybe you wouldn't have ever thought that would be in that, and certainly those are things that you just have to work through, and it's from our perspective here, I think that we've gotten our record is probably indicative of how we've played, a little bit up, a little bit down, and we have to get off that treadmill. We have to continue to find a way to become consistent and to become better, and we can't be afraid to take different looks at how things can be done in that regard.
Thanks.
All right, guys.
Winnipeg Jets general manager Kevin Cheveldayoff, after the trade of Alexei Ponikarovsky back to the New Jersey Devils in exchange for a fourth-round pick and a seventh-round pick, occurred about 45 minutes ago. It's a fourth-round pick and it's a seventh-round pick for a guy who obviously wasn't doing really much of anything with the Winnipeg Jets.
Nope, he wasn't performing, and that's why they moved him. Pretty simple.
And you're just...
I'm not even going to say anything. Enough's enough about breaking down the Alexei Ponikarovsky trade.
Keep your eye on.
We're going to finish Wednesday's show with Keep an Eye On. Richie, start it off. What should people keep their eye on this week?
Keep an eye on Brendan Dillon tonight in the second half of the TSN doubleheader. He's a nice young defender. He's mean. And I like his game. And I like the way he's progressed this year. It's been obviously a small sample, but... And keep an eye on him.
Keep an eye on Brendan Dillon. Ezzie Ginsberg, what should people keep an eye on?
Well, last week I went with Jacob Josephson of the New Jersey Devils, and I'm going to go stick in the Eastern Conference. I'm going to go with a guy that people are probably already keeping their eye on, but I'm going to go with Mikhail Grigorenko. He only has 3 points in 12 games for the Buffalo Sabres, but he has otherworldly skill. He's so talented, so quick, such good puck skills. He's been buried a little bit on the third line, but I think he's still going to rebound and compete with Vladimir Tarasenko of the St. Louis Blues for Rookie of the Year. So keep your eye on Grigorenko, drafted 12th overall in 2012. Could have easily gone higher. He's a great player, and I think he's going to start to improve as the season goes along.
And I will wrap up Keep Your Eye On by keeping my eye on the situation in St. Louis with the St. Louis Blues. There were very high hopes for the Blues at the start of the year, and they started the season strong, but have lost 5 games in a row, including 3 blowout losses on home ice. The pressure is mounting, as evidenced by this quote from David Backes. "We've got too many guys out there looking at the stat sheet, wondering how many goals and assists they've got, rather than taking a hit to make a play so we can get the puck out of our zone so that your teammates can have a 3-on-2. If things continue to spiral down in St. Louis, and with expectations so high, change may be afoot for the St. Louis Blues." That's it for this Wednesday edition of the NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve Hockey Show. A big thank you to Matt Lachlan, New Jersey Devils play-by-play man. In case you missed any of this program, it will be available for download on iTunes, on the IllegalCurve.com website, and on TSN1290.ca. You can follow us on Twitter at Illegal Curve. You can follow us on Facebook, facebook.com/IllegalCurve. And the website is www.illegalcurve.com. Saturday afternoon, 12 noon to 3 p.m., the Illegal Curve Hockey Show will be on this fine station. For my colleagues Richard Pollock and Ezra Ginsberg, for producer Michael Remus, I'm your host, Drew Mindell. Thank you for listening, and we wish you a good night and good luck.
You've been listening to NHL Midweek with the Illegal Curve. Join us every Wednesday at 6 p.m. for your midweek NHL update. And join Drew Mindell, Richard Pollock, and Ezra Ginsberg Saturdays for the Illegal Curve Hockey Show on your home of the Winnipeg Jets and all things NHL. TSN 1290. TSN 1290.ca.